I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. As you probably know by now, the interview will not debut on Christmas Day. Sony Pictures pulled the movie after theaters said they wouldn't show it, fearing threats of violence. Hackers alleged to be from North Korea hacked Sony and stole millions of documents. They said that the release of the film would result in attacks not unlike September 11th. Later, we'll talk about other films that have sparked controversy and the standoff between the U.S. and North Korea. But first, how is this playing in Hollywood and the film industry? And joining us is Andrew Wallenstein. He's co-editor-in-chief for Variety. Got up real early in the morning to join us on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.
No problem.
You wrote recently that Sony really made the right call on this, that caution was really the right approach to this really uncharted territory. Explain your thinking there.
Sure. And just to be clear, that's my opinion. Yes. This is something that's been subject to a lot of debate here in Hollywood. You know, and there's a lot of people in the creative community who have argued the opposite, that essentially they have Sony has, you know, has been cowed by North Korea, and that has a chilling effect that would obviously hurt any sort of film or television project that would be of offense to, you know, any foreign power that has a problem with the U.S. But what I argued was, you know, from a business perspective, it was only prudent for the movie theaters or the studio to be in a situation where they are avoiding legal liability. If you think back to 2012 and the shooting at the Aurora, Colorado movie theater during a screening of The Dark Knight that left 12 dead, you know, the theater owners there were sued over 20 times, and a federal judge actually very recently argued that they were, you know, allowed to be sued because they could have potentially foreseen such an incident happening. So if an incident like that was foreseeable, certainly what we're talking about here with the interview where a threat was very clearly made was foreseeable.
So you, from your perspective, you took these threats seriously?
Yes, and I'm obviously fully aware that, you know, the Department of Homeland Security said that there was no credible evidence that threat was real. But, I mean, let's be honest, we saw North Korea, or, you know, that's what we're saying at this point in terms of who is responsible for this attack, pulled off a very sophisticated cyber attack. I think it was certainly within the realm of possibility that they could have escalated this attack with violence.
A movie that Steve Carell was going to be involved in, involving North Korea, apparently has been shelved. People feared that that this is the kind of chilling effect that that the pulling of the interview is going to have. Agree? Disagree?
Absolutely. I mean, you look at that incident and it tells you everything you need to know about the potential for a chilling effect. I've never said that I didn't believe there wouldn't be a chilling effect. However, that's, you know, in the heat of the moment of what is going on right now. And in my view, in the longer term, I really personally don't believe that such a chilling effect would have a long-term or permanent effect on Hollywood creative. I think, you know, great content finds its way to the screens. And some might say that's naive, but, you know, I think in time, with a little distance from this incident, the right projects would make it to the screen.
I was reading about George Clooney putting together a petition looking for others who wanted to, in a sense, stand against these hackers. And from what I read, he didn't get a lot of takers. What does that tell us about Hollywood?
Well, that tells you something very clear, which is while I think there is tremendous sympathy throughout the business for what Sony is going through, there's also, you know, some defensiveness and some fear that should any studio, for instance, band together with Sony on this, they could open themselves up to be a threat to North Korea. I mean, when something like this happens to a studio, you better believe every other studio town is wondering, am I next? What could it be for me? And by the way, I don't think that fear extends, or I should say that fear does extend beyond Hollywood. I mean, I think anyone in corporate America, whether you make candy, cars, cuckoo clocks, is seeing what happened with Sony and saying the same thing. In this very ironic way, a movie studio has become a dramatization of the dangers of what happens when cybersecurity isn't at its utmost.
And how damaged is Sony, at least today?
Oh, I mean, there's, you know, this is a company that has been completely destabilized and weeks later is still sort of tunneling out from the fact that all their systems were downed. And this, you know, estimates have said this is going to cost, you know, well more than at least, you know, $100 million. And that's not counting, you know, the tens of millions they're going to lose just on pulling the interview by itself.
You wrote an interesting piece about your own struggle about what to do with this stolen information and, in a sense, made the case for at least publishing some of it. And, of course, that puts you in line for criticism that you're doing the work of the hackers. Explain your justification for us.
Sure. Not a decision we arrived at easily. And, you know, I think we've tried to be very prudent about what we did and what we didn't publish. But we were very sensitive and understood the criticism, as you just put it, that to some degree we're functioning as pawns for these hackers by maximizing the exposure of the content that they created. And look, if we were the only publication in existence, we probably would not have done this. But the fact of the matter is, dozens of publications and blogs went to town on this story. And that was amplified by social media, and here we are as, you know, Variety, the publication that covers the industry. We can't just sit back and abstain and say nothing, because my prime directive as the editor-in-chief is to make sure what's in our pages is reflecting what is talked about in this industry, and no one is talking about anything else but this in this industry. So we had to be there, and, you know, we've been judicious. We haven't, you know, reported on anything and everything. And I should argue, you know, from a legal ground, even though, yes, Sony did threaten to sue us and many other publications, this is very much within fair use. You know, we have not, you know, put out movie scripts. We have not put out personally identifiable information. So we have not been as reckless as some critics have suggested everyone in the media is being.
And do we need to know that Angelina Jolie is a minimally talented, spoiled brat, one of the email postings that has gone public?
Fair question, and I'll tell you why we do.
Okay.
From, you know, Variety is a publication that is all about the entertainment industry. And while certainly, without question, something like what you just said is gossip, when it is talked about by major figures in the industry and that speech in and of itself endangers their jobs, and, you know, if you read Variety, what these people's jobs are all about, whether they have them or not, is obviously topic A. We do need to write about it. I mean, what if in the other instance, the more, you know, famous instance that's arisen from this situation where studio chief Amy Pascal made comments in an email regarding President Obama that seemed to be pretty racially insensitive. If she had lost her job, or forget about that, when she apologized, which she did, would we have reported on the apology but not on what she apologized about? I mean, it's very difficult to draw the line at what to publish and what to not. And unfortunately, yes, we've had to wade in the muck of some of the gossip here.
I'm sure you read Aaron Sorkin's piece in the New York Times. Just one quote here. He says, every news outlet that did the bidding of the Guardians of Peace is morally treasonous and spectacularly dishonorable. What do you say back to Aaron Sorkin?
You know, I'm sensitive to where he's coming from. Certainly his own name was dragged through the mud by a studio chief. But, you know, the guy who created The Newsroom, that's an HBO series about the news business, should have a more nuanced understanding of what we actually do. And, you know, I, again, sensitive to where he's coming from, but that's so over the top.
So how do people feel about Seth Rogen in Hollywood today?
I think there's sympathy for Seth Rogen. I think, you know, this town respects, you know, satire. This town respects, you know, comedy. And you know, the truth is, the irony of all this is, the movie isn't understood to be terribly good. It did not get well reviewed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, no one wants to feel as if they need to tiptoe around public figures who deserve to be offended, kind of as President Obama put it.
Well, and I'm curious about, especially in the you know, in the days or the era of streaming. I mean, there's so many workarounds where people don't need to go to the movie theater to see a movie. I was reading that Sony might use its streaming service. I believe it's called Crackle. Do you think that will be the workaround?
It does seem to be the case. The Michael Lenton, the chairman of the studio, over the weekend very clearly indicated that is the route they are looking to go. They are talking to everybody, supposedly, YouTube, Google, anyone who could stream. And there's a lot of different players out there besides Sony's own Crackle. We'll see if a deal gets done. The thing that I find interesting is, if they do that deal, to me, there's no question there's going to be yet another data leak from the hackers. But apparently, after getting criticized by President Obama, after getting criticized by so many in the creative community, they would rather suffer through their 10th leak than look like people trampling on the First Amendment.
Are you surprised that this story has taken off the way it has?
Yes and no. Yes, because it's just, you know, we're, you know, 2-3 weeks into the story and it feels just as surreal as it did on its very first day. We've never seen anything like this. And on the other hand, though, it's so spectacularly weird that I get the tremendous interest in it.
And you seem to indicate that maybe short-term Hollywood or the movie industry is going to kind of keep things careful, but perhaps over time begin to get back into the business of satire and things like that. Is that how you anticipate things going forward?
I really do, and I know Hollywood doesn't want to hear that, but you know, these kinds of things, these sort of shifting sensibilities in Hollywood always, always turn out to be cyclical. Think back to, you know, some of the major tragedies that have occurred with regard to, you know, school shootings, which has always invoked a lot of hand-wringing about violence in films and are they influential or not. And you always hear tremendous amounts of, you know, misgivings by those in the industry, around the industry, and there seems to be this sense of, okay, violent movies, you know, maybe it's time we give this a break. It never goes away. Yeah. And to the industry's credit, in this case, I just don't think you're going to see Hollywood, you know, shut down the business of creating programming that is great satire and takes people to task who should be taken to task.
I bet there'll be a big audience when the interview finally does air. Andrew Wallenstein, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Anytime.
Co-editor-in-chief for Variety. We're going to take a very short break. Then we'll be talking about the relationship between the United States and North Korea. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The North Korean government has denied responsibility for hacking Sony Pictures and stealing millions of documents. The U.S. has accused the DPRK of launching the attack, and on Friday, President Obama said the U.S. would have a proportional response. Yesterday, North Korea's internet network failed. Strange coincidence? Joining us now is Catherine Moon. She's senior fellow in the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, also professor of political science at Wellesley College. And Catherine Moon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
So what do we make of the fact that yesterday the DPR, at least part of the internet in North Korea, failed?
Well, many are speculating about this. First of all, it was apparently about a 10-hour break. It wasn't a total failure, but it was massive disruptions, weak signals. So it's not clear that it was an attack, but it's possible. One theory is it's possible that the North Koreans pulled the plug themselves to prevent any kind of hacking or retaliation from the U.S. or anybody else. Another possibility is that the U.S. might have done something. The U.S. government has not commented on it when they've been asked by reporters. There's also the possibility that the Chinese, who have significant access to the infrastructure of the North Korean internet system, computer systems, might have pulled the plug also to just send a message. So it's at this point, it's speculation.
Are you convinced, as the Obama administration at least seems to be publicly, that North Korea was behind the hacking of Sony Pictures?
Well, that's a tough question. I'm sure that the president would not have spoken so emphatically several days ago unless the government had some very serious and defining pieces of information and evidence. On the other hand, my knowledge and follow-up of independent cybersecurity firms as well as computer companies, many are skeptical that the North Koreans could have had the kind of breadth and depth capacity. They certainly have very sophisticated technology in cyber hacking. There's no doubt about that. But whether they could have made this operation that took 100 terabytes of information, which some former cyber hackers said it would take months, if not years, to conduct. And then what's, to me, very interesting is that in the early periods of investigation, people kept focusing on the similarities in the codes and the forensic evidence between the Sony hacking and the hacking of South Korean banks and telecommunications companies last year, South Korea being North Korea's traditional enemy. But as as the news cycle keeps going on about this, now we're seeing much more information about Russia, China, and Iran and their hacking software being very much the kind that seems to have been used in this recent attack on Sony. And there's even some evidence that this new attack on Sony included elements that the North Koreans have never used before. So, you know, I'm an academic analyst. I have to stay open-minded about this.
I was talking with Andrew Wallenstein, he has a very different job from yours, co-editor-in-chief for Variety. But he said from his perspective, he felt like Sony did the right thing, which is you just cannot take a risk in this uncertain world. I'd be curious about what your position is on what Sony did or what movie theaters did in a sense, pulling this movie, the interview.
Right. One, as an American, I'll just first say that it is very unfortunate. I don't think anybody meant this to become an act of self-censure, but I can understand concerns for safety. But let me first go back in terms of Sony's relationship with this film. We have evidence, reporters have done good jobs by looking at information even as just 6 months ago in June, that Sony was deliberating whether some of these more violent scenes that depict Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, being blown up and melting and, you know, and all that, whether this might be too much. And even the parent company of Sony Pictures based in Tokyo, even that CEO stepped in saying, you know, this might be going a little bit, might be too far-reaching in terms of the effect. And internally in Sony, there was a lot of discussion. There's also email evidence that Sony CEO and others had been in touch with members of the U.S. government about this. I don't know how much credibility, you know, there is in that. But so this has been something that's been a stew that's been cooking for a while. So I don't think anybody should take these recent events as something of a shocker or something that came and totally surprised us as if it were a real terrorist attack. That's number one. The other reality is that it's the movie theaters that made and forced the decision on Sony. So it really wasn't Sony per se, because after the attack, the cyber attack, they were still willing to release it. But what's interesting is that the threat message is what freaked people out. And I separate the hacking from the threat message as an analyst because my reading of the threat message, Marty, is it's not the usual North Korea speak. It doesn't have the signature that it usually puts on its aggressive, threatening rhetoric. And the more people look at this who are in the know, they think this is odd. This is odd language, odd phrasing, odd use, and odd references. And apparently, the attacks had come first, and there had been no real mention about the interview as the prime target until everybody started talking about the interview. This is from the GOP, the Guardians of Peace, the alleged source of the hacking.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Catherine Moon, and she's a senior fellow in the Center for East Asia Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, professor of political science at Wellesley College, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about the controversy surrounding the movie The Interview. It will not be released as was planned and promised on Christmas Day. And as we know, it's caused quite a ruckus in this country and raised a whole host of questions about cyber hacking, cybersecurity, the relationship between the U.S. and North Korea. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Catherine, from what you know about Kim Jong-un and certainly the family that he came from, we understand that they do like movies. But nonetheless, I can't imagine if someone in North Korea made a satire about Kim Jong-un like The Interview, what would happen to them in that country? And I guess what I'm trying to understand is how does North Korea either understand or even misunderstand what a satire is?
Well, that's a philosophical question, I guess. But
sorry
I have
about
a
that.
Answer. That, no, the philosophical questions are good. They're
it's kind
fun.
Of early in the morning for it, but that's okay. No, go ahead.
The first question you ask about what would happen if it had been North Koreans who had made this film, that's just, it's impossible. I mean, it's impossible that anybody would be bold enough to do it because you would face probably the end of your life and be made a terrible example of. As many people know, the North Korean state is in a way a secular theocracy, with Kim Jong-un, the current leader, his father and his grandfather, the founder, serving as the Holy Trinity. And so if people in their own society had done this, it is a sacrilege to the state religion, so to speak. It is absolute treachery, treason to the state. And so it just would not have been tolerated. And your second question, the philosophical one?
Yeah, let me just do then a follow up to that, because does this then, I guess, reveal just the differences between this is a country that prides itself in having a First Amendment, and obviously in North Korea there is no such thing, and yet things are released internationally these days. Nothing is self-contained except from perhaps in North Korea.
Right. Oh yes, you talked about film. Do they understand satire?
Yeah.
In some ways. I mean, for us, it's easier to say that life in or politics, rather, in North Korea seems to be a satire or a fantasy or, something absolutely surreal to us. But to North Koreans, it makes sense. That's what they've known. And as far as the film entertainment world goes, the North Koreans do not separate film, entertainment, art from state propaganda. The government has to approve of all public productions and showings. And so there might be somebody doing something on an independent level, but they would have to be doing it in a serious secret in an armed bunker somewhere. But normally, no. There is no such thing called satire. I think the closest thing that the North Koreans would have to satire is making fun of the United States and South Korea, its traditional enemy. But that's part of the propaganda. And I think it's been hard for the North Koreans to understand, but, you know, they are not clueless. They're not as isolated and as off the wall as people often assume. There are North Korean officials who have been speaking with different Americans quietly, saying they understand why the Americans are so upset about this, and they can even understand why the U.S. government is upset. But they say that they have not done this. And, you know, of course, many people don't believe them, and they have to deny it. But at the same time, they do have some understanding of what's going on. I think what really surprised some of these North Korean diplomats is that this notion that for the first time a cyber hacking has entered the personal lives and potentially the living rooms and, of course, movie theaters, the private lives of Americans, that is a different reality for them, because private lives are not something that are safeguarded in North Korea.
Let me get John. Looks like calling us from Northern Liberties. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'll try to keep it brief. I'm on. The traffic's not too great here. I have some experience in information security. About 10 years ago, I quit doing that. But I still read every day on all this, the subject. And my opinion very strongly is that North Korea did not commit this. Unfortunately, a lot of people would be able to do this now, because partly because of what our own government has done in putting back doors into Microsoft software. The only tenuous evidence they have is that it was Korean language packs that were the initial vector for the attack. And it's pretty soft. But if you go and look at the at news readings from the last couple of years, they've caught North Korean hackers. They had like a whole hotel floor in South Korea, and they unraveled their whole thing. They weren't that sophisticated. And at this time, some hackers have taken out all of North Korea's pipe to the internet. Like, they're DDoSing it, which means they're denial of servicing their entire internet connection out of the country.
Yeah, so, well, John,
they're really not at that level.
Yeah, let me just take your comments in. And Catherine, it sounds like he's saying that they just don't have the they would not have the sophistication to do what was done to Sony. Agree?
Yeah, I agree. Again, they do have very sophisticated capacity, human capacity as well as technological, more than the outside world has ever known or would like to acknowledge. But the reality is, and again, I've been reading on independent cybersecurity firms' assessments. The question is, would they have the capacity to do the kind of damage in a very complex operation that included computers and routers, not only North Korea, China, but also through Italy, Thailand, Singapore, Poland, Cyprus. So this has been a massive effort. And as John had just mentioned, there are, you know, these other kinds of evidence that it's not just the Korean language in the coding, but there's other evidence that show that this was not your usual North Korean attack. So I think he's on to something.
John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Something else I was reading that I wanted to ask you about, Catherine Moon, which is, and this was actually in the New Republic. The headline was "Stop Making Fun of North Korea." And when you look at a number of films, it depicts it as a kind of strange and silly place.
Yes.
With the idea that while that might be true, it's also a place where people are persecuted and tortured and kept in prison. And there are, as I understand it, public executions and looks like almost like mass starvation. I just want our listeners to understand what life is like for the average everyday North Korean.
Well, first of all, the period of mass starvation is over. The North Koreans have been doing very well, and the last two summers provided very good harvests. So, and they have been working to increase food capacity, and there are NGOs from the West, from South Korea, and elsewhere who've been assisting in capacity building. So those are positive things. But in terms of North Korea being portrayed as this goofy, surreal, crazy place, I think that is part of our problem in terms of dealing with North Koreans, that if the U.S. in particular chooses, and if Americans choose to look at any country and any leader as basically off the wall and not real, then it becomes very difficult to actually do real diplomacy and hard work with them. And I think many have been just expecting North Korea to disintegrate, and it has not happened. So the big question is, if, hypothetically even, we accept that the North Korean regime will not go away anytime in the near future, then we have to decide, as a country and as a government, how to deal with the reality. And do you make the relationship worse? Or do you somehow learn to live with something you don't like and you don't support in terms of moral and other values, but learn to deal with it? And I think it's interesting that this North Korea issue came up right after our opening to Cuba. And I think President Obama was stuck in a hard place, that within a two-three-day period, he was confronted with, you know, this historical news. He made historical news by saying we're going to open up with Cuba after decades and decades of very bad relations. And the reality is, the fact is, Cuba didn't disappear. And so if that is to happen to North Korea, we need to decide, how are we going to deal with it? Do we have another Cuba situation, or worse, because it has nuclear weapons for the next 60 years? I think that's an unrealistic proposition.
And we're almost out of time here. Do you think once the DVD is released in this country, it will make it into North Korea? 10 seconds?
I would think so. North Koreans have become individual North Koreans, and this is where the people, the emphasis on the people should be different from the emphasis on the state. Some of the people are very curious about the outside world. They are resourceful, getting internet access, and so we should not fool around with individuals' ability to try to get even stolen internet access. And then DVDs, they get smuggled in regularly, music, all sorts of things.
Well,
so
we have
most likely will.
I'm sorry to do that to you, Catherine Moon. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And stay
Thank
with
you
it.
Very much.
You're very
Thank
welcome.
You.
Stay with us. A third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscow-Aim. The Interview is not the first movie to cause controversy or even an international incident. Sony pulled the picture after theaters said they wouldn't show it, fearing threats of violence by hackers alleged to be working for the government of North Korea. Joining us now is Thomas Dougherty. He's a professor of American Studies and chair of the American Studies program at Brandeis University. He's an associate editor for the film magazine Cineast and film review editor for the Journal of American History. And even more, he wrote a book called Hollywood and Hitler. Thomas Dougherty, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Has the release of a movie, and we're talking about the interview here, ever been stopped because of threats? Is this a first?
I've been talking with a lot of people in the biz and scholars, too, to see if there's a precedent to this where a major studio release has been pulled by threats of terrorism. And I frankly can't come up with one. There have been plenty of instances in Hollywood history where a movie is pulled or protested. Sometimes a movie is not made because a foreign country will object to it. There's a really famous example in 1937, a film called The 40 Days of Musadag, based on a Franz Werth novel about the Armenian genocide, was protested by Turkey. They said they wouldn't let any Hollywood films into Turkey in 1937 if MGM made this film. So MGM pulls the plug. So there are a lot of examples of that kind of accommodation that Hollywood makes. But I cannot think in the history of Hollywood where there's been an equivalent example of something that's happened in this last week.
And how about
a film that's made that is pulled because of a threat of terrorism, that the people in the theater will be harmed? Usually what people go after is the film itself, but they will not threaten the people actually in the theater. And that's why I think this is so important and so frazzling, the situation we're in right now, because it's really something new in the history of Hollywood cinema.
Do you see it as a slippery slope? I mean, the fact that theaters did not want to show it. I mean, obviously, we have to take their concerns as legitimate. But nonetheless, do you see this as a slippery slope?
I think it's more than a slippery slope. Like, it's a major turning point. I agree that with your first guest, Andrew Wallenstein, that Sony did the right thing when they first got the threat that on Christmas Day there would be, you know, 9/11 death and destruction rained down upon American motion picture theaters. And so that's like 35,000 targets of opportunity in America. And whoever did this, whether it's the North Koreans or some other group, have proven they're really good at cyber terrorism, right? Mm. They get into the, you know, they've managed to sack Sony, you know, very well. So the notion that they could also, you know, put a bomb or a zealot in an American theater is not beyond the realm of possibility. But I think the situation we're in now is that I think the government and Hollywood have to cooperate, that the government has to tell us who did this, provide protection, and then Hollywood has to release the film, I would say theatrically. You know, I'd want to go to the film as a consumer. And I don't think it should just be released on Crackle or something. That as a moviegoer and as an American citizen, like, you know, believe it or not, I'd pay $10 on video on demand or go to my local theater just as kind of a gesture for the First Amendment. And I think a lot of people feel that way, too.
Well, I would agree with you on that. It's funny, having conversations with people in my world, I think that was the general consensus, whether it's a good movie or not. The idea of at least...
Right. I don't care anymore about the quality of the film. But, you know, if Sony says, you know, we're going to show it on January 12th at 8 o'clock, it'll be released, you know, in theaters and video on demand. And Americans come out and support this film. I think a lot of people would do this. And, you know, some people are saying, well, it's a frivolous movie, it's a bonehead comedy, but, you know, that's our freedom of expression. And, I mean, if you can't make fun of Kim Jong-un, who can you make fun of? I mean, if anybody deserves homicidal ridicule, it's a maniac like this fellow.
Well, let me pick up on that, and I do want to talk about, you know, The Great Dictator and some other films that have made about Hitler. But in those films, was Hitler ever blown up as apparently he is in The Interview?
No,
he's satirized. He's made
wartime
fun
films.
Of.
He is, and that there's actually maybe a better example, less known than The Great Dictator, a 1941 film called Manhunt, in which you actually see Hitler in the crosshairs of a sniper rifle, and the guy, is about to shoot him, and then he gets the bead, and then when he puts the other bullet in the gun, that's when he's interrupted. So there are a lot of sort of fantasy World War II films about killing Hitler and Captain America and comic books and things. So this is certainly in the public imagination, but. Ridicule is a really good way to take down a dictator. And sure, we acknowledge that North Korea is a Stalinist prison camp, just as we acknowledge what the Nazis did during World War II. But when you think of films like The Great Dictator or To Be or Not to Be, The Three Stooges did a couple of hilarious shorts before the Second World War, before American entry into the Second World War, that were clearly about Hitler. I mean, that's one of the ways you take down a dictator, because these guys, are notoriously lacking in a sense of humor.
Indeed. Well, Springtime for Hitler is another example, a more recent film, obviously. Let me just run this by you, because I did not know about this. I was reading about a film that was shown in 1939, Confessions of a Nazi Spy. This was in Milwaukee, in a Milwaukee movie theater, and I guess the audience was pro-German, or certain numbers of the audience pro-German, threatened to burn the theater down? Yes?
Yeah, right. There are a couple of incidences with Confessions of a Nazi Spy, because the film was it came out in April of 1939, before World War II had erupted in Europe, much less before America had entered the Second World War. And there was some objection to that. There were some death threats, bomb threats coming into theater owners. But Warner Brothers was behind the film totally. Jack and Harry Warner were avid anti-Nazis. They made the film knowing it would be controversial, knowing it would be getting some opposition, and in a place like Milwaukee, maybe a little bit more than the usual opposition. But they went behind it. They hired a plainclothes policemen and guards, American Legion veterans in some places, stood in front of theaters to protect the right of Americans to go see a motion picture. So there are examples, or Birth of a Nation, maybe even a more notorious example, which, of course, had widespread protest against it and widespread protest in favor of it. So there have been incidences throughout Hollywood history of this kind of thing, but nothing quite to this scale, where you have apparently a foreign power threatening Americans at their home. I mean, Hitler didn't do that with The Great Dictator or To Be or Not to Be. in the early 1940s. They, of course, made anti-Semitic comments about Chaplin and Ernst Lubitsch, but they never threatened to blow up Americans in their theaters if they went to these movies. And if the Nazis had done that in 1940 or 41, you can imagine how FDR would have responded.
Well, that's interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Thomas Daugherty, and we are talking about the threats against the movie The Interview, and he is the author of a book called Hollywood and Hitler, talking about other films that have satirized dictators. And we want to find out from you whether you plan to see the movie, were you planning to see the movie, you're going to plan to see the movie now. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And Thomas Daugherty, we have a comment from Ken, says, if the movie ever plays, it will be the first and only time I ever see a Seth Rogen film.
well, this guy's taking the hit for the First Amendment, right?
Yes, exactly. But, I think with, when things are censored, that generally does create a heightened interest in something, whatever that thing that is censored. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, but I think as your first guest was talking about, and I think you brought up, that there is this chilling effect. Movies already might be that are in the pipeline will be canceled, and then there'll be a whole range of projects that will just be off the map of realization because of what's happened with The Interview. Mm-hmm. And it might just not apply to, say, North Korean scenarios, but Islamic terrorism. There are a whole range of issues that you can think of that will offend foreign nationals that don't share our same sense of the breadth of the First Amendment that will not get made because of what's happened with the situation with The Interview, which I really think is why it's so imperative that this film be out there and that as citizen moviegoers we can sort of give our support for the First Amendment.
Are you surprised there aren't protests over this film?
You mean protests that by people
saying we want to see this film? North Korea can't tell us what movies
and
we want to see.
In New York, I just read in the Times this morning that there's going to be a live reading of the screenplay for the Interview. And I know that several theaters wanted to show Team America World Police, the truly comedic classic by Stone and Parker, the South Park guys, who the marionette satire of the father of Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-il, which, if memory serves, he turns into a cockroach at the end of that movie. And that is just a hilarious send-up of the dictator. And several theaters wanted to show that film, and Paramount pulled that because of liability. So there are two comedy classics, or one comedy classic and one maybe fairly good comedy, that are out there that we can't see because of these cyber terrorists.
Let me see what Leon from Conshohocken has to say. Leon, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi
there.
A while ago, they made a movie called Moon Over Parador, and it was clearly about some South American banana republic. Why not put this movie in a fictional place from the beginning? Why put it in North Korea? Why the need for that?
Well, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Thomas Daugherty, as I understand it, some back and forth, I guess, between Sony and Seth Rogen and some of the filmmakers was, do you really have to use the name Kim Jong-un when you're making this film?
They were being transgressive, and they actually wanted to go after the real guy. And, maybe you could have made the same point like Charlie Chaplin did with The Great Dictator by, calling Adolf Hitler Adenoid Hinkel. And, they shared the toothbrush mustache. So obviously everybody was connecting the dots with something like The Great Dictator. Or Woody Allen and Bananas when, the South American dictator or the Caribbean dictator is clearly modeled on Fidel Castro. So we've got a lot of examples of that in film history, but we also have some examples where you actually sort of name the personality, like in some of the anti-Hitler films. I think they were clearly within their rights to do this, whether it was good judgment or not. I remember when I saw the trailers, I thought, I really have to see this given one's interest in North Korea, and then having seen Team America and World Police, which seemed to like ratchet this up a different level by having actual real people.
Let me see what Dan from West Philadelphia has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I just was calling because I'm in the minority where I think Sony did the right thing by deciding not to to at least release the movie theatrically. But also, I keep hearing this being, to me, it's being confused as a First Amendment issue, which I don't think it is, because it's not our government telling Sony what to do or not do. And Sony is exercising its First Amendment right, which is freedom of speech, by choosing to not do something, which is also a form of freedom of speech. And I know that there's the argument that there's a slippery slope. If you do one thing, you have to do another, which I personally have never bought into. I think there is shades of gray that a person can evaluate. And I think the fact that this is kind of a cornball, cheesy comedy gives it credence to say, you know what, we don't want to put people in danger over something this silly. And, you know, I personally, you know, I'm almost more afraid of, you know, people in this own country. This movie has gotten so much attention, and there's enough risk. Just, you know, you see shootings and so forth. There's attention on this movie now. I could see, you know, it's almost impossible to guard against one person going into a theater with a gun.
Well, Dan, let me
a name for themselves.
Yeah, let me take your essential point, because I think it's interesting, and I want to get Thomas Daugherty's response, basically saying this is a silly movie and it's not worth our protest or upset. I'm sort of overstating that a little bit, but basically saying this is not a First Amendment issue and this is not worth of our protest.
Well, who knows whether it's a silly movie, man? You know, I don't think it's going to be the Citizen Kane of comedy, but, you know, I mean, Charles Chaplin's The Great Dictator, Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, or even The Three Stooges when they're sending up Adolf Hitler in 1940 and 41. I mean, those are useful things to do. And I really admire these guys for making a movie about North Korea, you know, putting our focus on it. And I really do think it is a First Amendment issue. Like, when people are threatened to blow you up if you don't, you know, if you show a movie, or if you write a book, or if you express yourself on the street in a nonviolent way. I mean, that is the First Amendment, and the government has got to protect that right. I mean, movies are important. They're you know, they're our culture. They're a part of the way we discuss everything: race, sex, you know, politics. And they really have to be protected. And it's why I think this is really an imperative issue. It's why everybody is, I think, talking about it. One of your callers or your former speaker mentioned that, you know, on the day this broke, Obama also opened relationships with Cuba.
Right.
And I think that this story might be the more important one in the long run. Because we have sort of the first successful act of cyber terrorism, and then an act in which Americans' First Amendment rights have been really seriously threatened by a foreign power.
And we're also out of time here, but are you saying the solution to this is just open the film and go see it and stand up for satire and the free speech?
Yeah, and I want to see the government ascertain who did this. And then I think we need to make a decision about what we're going to do. And my decision would be I want to, you know, see this at a motion picture theater and pay my $11 plus popcorn.
Plus popcorn. Always popcorn. Thomas Daugherty, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And again, Professor.
It's been a pleasure, Marty.
A pleasure for us as well. And it is an important issue. I agree with you. He's a professor of American Studies, chair of the American Studies program at Brandeis University. He wrote a book called Hollywood and Hitler, and he's the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook and Twitter, and how to find us on satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.